Our next case this morning is number 06-1720 and 06-1767, Ray Wolf against Texaur Petroleum Company.
Good morning, Mr. Rhodes.
Good morning, Your Honor. I'm not sure if opposing counsel is here. I have not seen him.
Ah, yes.
Okay.
I assume Mr. Rose is first, so I didn't step up.
Yes, Mr. Rose is first, if you would have a seat at council table. Sir, if you would sit at council table, please. Thank you.
May it please the court. Again, I'm Bruce Rose. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, and we are asking the court to reverse a grant of summary judgment in favor of the defendants on the basis of standing that was issued by the district court. And we're also asking this court to affirm the denial of the defendant's 12B6 motion to dismiss the complaint, as well as the denial of the appellee's request for attorney's fees. As the court's aware, this is brought under the Petroleum Marketing Practices Act, federal statute governing the relations between gasoline, among other people, gasoline distributors and retailers, which the original appellant, the named party, was. The case was brought in the name of the individual, Mr. Rauf, originally. In the course of discovery, it became apparent that there was actually an underlying S corporation that Mr. Rauf, at the time of the filing of this lawsuit, was the sole officer, director, and stockholder. Our belief at the time of midway through discovery was that Texaur, the appellee, was fully aware of the existence of the corporation, or at least that there was another entity out there in which Mr. Rauf was acting on behalf of at all times. And given some of the exchanges went back and forth between counsel regarding discovery and the fact that we were producing corporate documents as opposed to Mr. Rauf's individual documents, it began to appear that, and I use that word advisedly, it began to appear that the real party in interest, assuming that Texaur knew of the existence of another entity out there besides Mr. Rauf, that the real party in interest may be or may have been this corporation, SHL 95. As a result...
Well, you didn't take the position that that may be the case. You took the position that that was the case and that the claim belonged to the corporation and not to your individual client, and you took that position as a factual matter, and it seems to me you shouldn't be permitted to argue to the contrary now.
Well, we took that position. I think most of my statements, if not all of my statements, were couched in terms of it appeared or counsel concluded and so on. And again, that was based on our belief and our understanding and Mr. Rauf's belief, frankly, that Texaur was aware that it was dealing with a corporation, and therefore the corporation, under those circumstances, could well be the real party in interest as well as a party withstanding to bring the case.
Well, whether your opponent knew about it or not is irrelevant here for purposes of the case as it stands now. I mean, you sued in the name of the wrong party and didn't seek leave to substitute the real party in interest until the last day of discovery, and the district court said that was prejudicial and denied the motion, and so here we are.
Well, actually, Your Honor, discovery was still continuing, as I've indicated. Discovery was extended. We were still taking factual discovery. There were subpoenas outstanding from Texaur. We were still in the process of doing expert discovery. So
that's because a motion to compel was required.
Well, actually,
your motion was filed on the deadline for the completion of discovery. You hadn't complied with previously filed discovery requests, and a motion to compel was necessitated, and that's what warranted the extension.
Well, that's the way Texaur has characterized it, however, Your Honor. If we go to the transcript...
Is that true or is that not true?
With all due respect, I don't believe that it is, Your Honor.
So there wasn't a motion to compel that was necessitated?
No, there was a motion
by foot-dragging on your part?
There was a motion to compel filed, but not justifiably, is our position. We had produced the documents we had. We had not produced documents that we did not have, and Mr. Rauf had already testified to that. And the only outstanding issue was the actual written responses to document requests as opposed to the production of the documents, which had been accomplished. because everything was being done on a fairly tight schedule. I got opposing counsel the documents before actually filing the written responses, and then there were three requests to admit that had been answered by my predecessor. Evidently, there was an issue that arose about the adequacy of the answers. It was not clear to me in our exchanges of letters exactly what the issue was. Once the motion to compel was filed and we were before Magistrate Judge Mason, again, I explained, no problem, we would provide the answers, which we subsequently did. There was no stonewalling. There was nothing going on. There were a lot of allegations made in the motion to compel that were simply not correct. For example, the most obvious one is we were asked to produce documents that we'd withheld on the grounds of privilege, and we'd not withheld any documents on the grounds of privilege.
Well, setting aside the discovery disputes, the fact remains that you did take the position as a factual matter that the real party in interest was the corporation, and now you're here making all kinds of arguments that that's not the case.
Well, even if...
And that seems to me to be an inconsistent litigation position.
Again, that position was staked out in terms of real party in interest, not in terms of standing. Summary judgment was granted on the issue of standing. So when we...
Right, but if your client doesn't own the claim, he doesn't have standing.
But as we went through three different possibilities, none of which were addressed by the district court, as to why he would have standing, one of which was the fact that, as we discussed a moment ago, Texor stated that it did not have any knowledge of the existence of the corporation. That would make the corporation both an undisclosed principal, in which case, under Illinois law, which governs in this situation, Mr. Raghav could sue in his individual name. Additionally, it also makes the corporation an unintended third-party beneficiary, which, again, by Illinois law, would not have standing to sue. Only Mr. Raghav could sue. So in terms of the real party in interest, there we are dealing with, under 17A, there what we're dealing with is whether or not there would be any subsequent prejudice to the defendant if the real party in interest could subsequently bring suit. We tried to alleviate that issue by, among other things, having the corporation issue a statement, a corporate resolution, saying that it would be bound by whatever the decision was in the district court so that there would be no danger of the corporation, any other purported real party in interest, coming back later and bringing suit. Summary judgment, however, was confined to the issue of standing alone. And on that basis, again, we have presented three different legal bases under which Mr. Raghav was entitled to bring suit in his own name. So I don't think there is any real inconsistency there. There was a position taken, again, based on a evidently mistaken belief as to who Texor believed it knew or whether it knew who it was dealing with. Once those facts became clear, that's when the adjustment was made. But there was no effort to delay the case. There was no stonewalling. I'm going back to Your Honor's comment about the motion being filed on the last day of discovery. This was an ongoing process. We began producing documents in April. We produced documents. Mr. Roof was deposed. There was written discovery exchanged, all within about a 90-day period. It was in the course of that, as the documents began being produced and counsel and I began exchanging letters, that I went back to the corporate counsel who had handled the transactions, trying to get the documents in terms of who owned the corporation, what had happened with the sale of the corporation, and so on. Those documents, and I think it's stated in the transcript of July 27th, those documents I had just gotten a few days earlier, had reviewed them, and don't remember the exact sequence either. I turned them over to counsel, or I was going to turn them over to counsel within a few hours at the continuation of Mr. Rowe's deposition. So contrary to the impression that the district court may have had or may have left, this was not some kind of an ambush. This was an effort to sort out a rather complicated factual background, trying to determine who the real party in interest was initially, and then subsequently that became an issue of who has standing to sue. And again, we've presented, I believe, three sound bases for Mr. Rowe bringing the lawsuit in his own name.
Do any of those bases survive the shareholder standing rule?
I believe they do, Judge.
In what way?
Because Mr. Rowe is also an agent of the corporation. He's wearing two hats, or was wearing two hats. He was a stockholder, but he was also the agent. He was also the individual who Texor claims it contracted with without knowledge of the existence of the corporation at all.
What evidentiary proof is there in the record to sustain any of these alternate theories, setting aside the issue of whether they're just end runs around the shareholder standing rule? What evidence is in the record to prove that he was acting as an agent for the corporation when he entered into this franchise relationship?
Texor's own statements, Your Honor. Texor repeatedly stated in the record it had no knowledge, no awareness whatsoever of SHL 95, the corporation. And that's what we cited to.
How does that prove that your client was acting as the agent for the corporation at the time he entered into this, what I understand is an oral agreement to supply gasoline?
Because at that point, it follows as a matter of law, Your Honor. If he is acting on behalf of someone or an entity that is not disclosed to the opposite party.
So the contract.
He's the agent, and he has personal liability. I mean, that's very well established. Again, that's why agents, corporate agents, usually sign if they don't want personal liability as president, vice president, whatever the title is or whatever the capacity is in which they're acting.
So the contract is with the corporation.
Well, there was no final contract. The contract, as far as Texor was concerned, was with Mr. Raouf. Mr. Raouf believed that that Texor knew of the corporation, but he at all times was acting under his own name, I guess, for want of a better way to describe it. He thought he had disclosed to Texor, but when asked to try to pin down the evidentiary details, the foundational details, to bring up a specific conversation or communication with Texor where he could say specifically, I told Texor on this date, he couldn't do it. It was one of those, well, everybody knew it. Texor disclaims any knowledge. Well, Texor had to be acting with someone. If it was not the corporation, then by necessity it had to be Mr. Raouf individually. And if so, then it's being done as the agent of the corporation because that's how the business was actually run. That's whose books we produce. That's where the income and the losses from the operation were reported on the corporate tax returns. It's the entity that owned the real estate on which the business was operated. It was simply unknown to Texor, evidently. In addition, Judge, we also ask that the denial of the motion to dismiss based on statute of limitations be affirmed. The district court denied that early on in the case. We believe that one of the purposes of the PMPA is to require a formal notice of termination so it is clear when a franchise agreement under the PMPA is in fact terminated. That was never done in this case, and I think that's been shown by the offerings of Texor, which have postulated a number of different dates, possible dates, when the case could be or when the franchise was terminated. These range from the date of service of a state court complaint against Mr. Raouf in August of 2001 back to April or March of 2001 when there was a dispute about evidently payment for some gasoline deliveries and a cessation of deliveries or a change to spotty deliveries at best, at least up through April of 2001. Given that situation, we believe the district court correctly found that the termination of the franchise occurred on August 29, 2001, when all evidence of signage, trademarks, and any other indicia of a Marathon franchise were removed from the station. We believe under the PMPA, particularly as it regards the definition of a franchise, that the district court's determination was absolutely correct on that point. If there are no further questions, I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
So thank you, Mr.
Thank
Rose.
You.
We'll hear now from Mr. Conway.
Morning, Your Honors. John Conway on behalf of Texor Petroleum.
I want to start with the statute of limitations issue. As Mr. Rose stated, that this is an action under the PMPA, Petroleum Marketing Practices Act. The PMPA has a one-year statute of limitations. It's statutory, and the case law that we've cited in our brief says that those cases are, and that statute is to be strictly applied. We've also cited cases, primarily the Johnson versus Amoco case, that says the statute begins to run at the instance where the party has knowledge of facts that would indicate he has a cause of action. We've cited to Mr. Raouf's answers to interrogatories where he states Texor wrongfully stopped selling us gasoline in April of 2001. At that instance where Mr. Raouf alleges that Texor committed this wrong, that's when the statute of limitations would run, and he had 1 year from that April date to file his lawsuit.
Did you renew your statute of limitations argument at the summary judgment phase?
I did not.
Then we're confined to a review of what was in the complaint, because the statute of limitations argument was raised in a 12B6 motion, and so we can't take into consideration what the answers to interrogatories and other discovery showed, at least as the case is presently postured.
Well,
a review of a denial of a 12B6. So what did the complaint say about accrual of the cause of action?
Well, as far as the summary judgment, we did raise the issue of what was said in the interrogatories in the motion for summary judgment. I guess I misconstrued your question.
Well, my question was whether your statute of limitations argument was reiterated and raised again at the summary judgment phase so the court could rule on it based on what discovery had disclosed about when the cause of action accrued. Because if you didn't, then we're stuck with what's in the complaint, because this is a review of a denial of a 12B6 motion on statute of limitations grounds.
Well, what's alleged in the complaint was that there was an agreement between Texor and between Mr. Raouf for the supply of gasoline. And what we raised in the 12B6 motion at that time was that the statute of limitations ran, and there was a request to admit that had been filed at that time, so it could be considered also, and admitted that the last delivery of gasoline was sometime in April of 2001.
What did the complaint say about when the agreement was terminated? Because that's when the statute of limitations would start to run, at least for purposes of a 12B6 motion.
Well, that's not the basis that the district court ruled upon. He did not say that whatever stated in the complaint is what's the date that it begins to run. What the district court relied upon was the date of some settlement agreement that was entered into between Texor and Raouf related to the state court action. The complaint actually states that the ultimate termination of the contract was August 22nd of 2001. That's what the complaint says, and our answer denies that. We also alleged in the 12B6 motion that the request to admit showed that an earlier date applied, that the statute of limitations should run much earlier when he was aware of the facts that give rise to his cause of action. With respect to the standing issue, Mr. Raouf has repeatedly admitted. He's admitted before this court, he admitted before the district court, and he's admitted in even in the document he relies upon, which is the resolution of the corporation, which states that the corporation owns these claims. That's the statement of their attorney. It's a statement of the corporation. That's the understanding of Mr. Raouf, and that's the argument he's stuck with. He can't now say that he personally is bringing his own action because he hasn't shown that he suffered any type of injury whatsoever. And the district court correctly ruled that he must show a direct injury. Article 3, which is what, you know, the first basis of standing, the Article 3 basis of standing, he must show a direct injury that's distinct to himself, and he's not. What he's doing is he's bringing an action personally seeking to recover damages that only accrued to the corporation. That's admitted in their resolution, and we cited that in their Rule 56 response papers that first showed up, not in discovery, but these papers that they rely on for all of their arguments showed up in response to our Rule 56 statement. They weren't provided in discovery, and that's another one of our arguments that why attorney's fees should accrue under the PMPA, number one. We cited Lindner versus Mobile, which says that in the event that the court does not have to construe the PMPA statute and the defendant obtains a judgment in their favor, then attorney's fees should be awarded under the PMPA. Now, the district court never reached a level where they construed the PMPA. And also, the attorney's fees here, we were brought into a case where Mr. Raouf filed this personally. At the end, the day of discovery ending, he brings up a case that says, wait a minute, I made a mistake. Those are the words of Mr. Raouf. Those aren't the words of Texor. He says, I made a mistake. And I think under the PMPA, Texor should not be allowed to pay for the mistake of Mr. Raouf. Our attorney's fees should be awarded under the PMPA. And then going back to the issue of standing, we do have the shareholder rule and the three bases that Mr. Raouf relies upon to skirt around the shareholder rule. And the primary cases of the shareholder rule are rulings of this court, which is Flynn versus Merrick and Carney versus GM. Carney versus GM is most appropriate because Mr. Carney in that case was a sole shareholder of a corporation. He alleged that the corporation was damaged, and Mr. Carney was trying to bring a case against GM based upon some damage to the corporation. And based on the shareholder rule, this court said, no, you don't have standing to bring that action. This court also determined the Flynn versus Merrick case, which also said that the shareholder must show some direct, distinct injury. In this case, Mr. Raouf absolutely cannot, admittedly cannot. It's the corporation that has the claim. And finally, the case that is also cited is Massey versus Merrill Lynch, which also says that the corporation must have a distinct injury, or I'm sorry, the shareholder must have this distinct injury. No such distinct injury, no such direct injury has ever been alleged, has ever been shown. With respect to this third-party beneficiary theory, Mr. Raouf has this backwards. He claims that the corporation is the third-party beneficiary, and the cases that he cites rule that in some instances a third-party beneficiary may have standing to bring a claim under a contract that they're not necessarily a party to, but that's not what Mr. Raouf is stating here. Mr. Raouf brought the claim in his name, not in the name of the third-party beneficiary. So his third-party beneficiary argument is backwards. He also alleges that there was some obvious assignment. Well, under the shareholder rule, any such obvious assignments would swallow up that rule, and you would no longer have the shareholder rule in the cases of any type of sole shareholder corporation. And this circuit, this court has already decided Carney versus GM, which debunks that theory. And his other theory is the obvious ratification and the written ratification. The written ratification that we have occurred in 2005, which is 3 years after even the time the statute of limitations ran, even according to Mr. Raouf. We've cited United States Supreme Court case of the National Election Commission versus the NRA, which says the ratification has to come before the statute of limitations ran. This one came 3 years later. And to get around that, Mr. Raouf says where there was an obvious ratification, and again, we go back to with that type of reasoning, that would swallow up the shareholder rule. And the cases that he cites with respect to that obvious ratification, none of them relate to standing, and none of them stand for the proposition that a shareholder may bring an action or a claim belonging to the corporation based on some sort of obvious ratification. What we're seeking is the affirmation of the motion for summary judgment in favor of Texor. We're also seeking an affirmation of the judgment in Texor based on the running of statute of limitations, and we think that the district court was incorrect in not awarding Texor its attorney's fees under the PMPA. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Conway. How much time does Mr. Rose have? Sir, you have 2 minutes.
Just to clarify, we are not disputing the fact that, in general, the rule is that a shareholder cannot bring a lawsuit in his own name, absent some unique injury to the shareholder. But that rule has emerged from cases in which it was clearly the corporation that was the contracting party, or where the corporation was clearly the injured party if it was a tort action. Here we're not dealing with that situation. This is a fairly unique situation where the other party claims that it had no awareness at all of the corporation, that it was contracting with the sole stockholder individually. That has been repeated throughout Texor's pleadings and briefs. It is on that basis that we're saying, therefore, since Texor, as far as it's concerned, did not contract with the corporation, and it was contracting with Mr. Rauf individually, and the fact that Mr. Rauf was acting ultimately, although unbeknownst to Texor, on behalf of the corporation, is what makes this a situation where Mr. Rauf was able to say, I was acting as the agent of an undisclosed principal, the corporation, which in turn would make him personally liable as a matter of law. I was acting, there was a contract entered into with me in which, because there was no mention at all of any other entity and no knowledge of it, that other entity is an unintended third-party beneficiary with no standing at all to bring a lawsuit. In this situation, the only person under those two theories that could bring the lawsuit would be Mr. Rauf himself, which is what he did. So on that basis, again, I don't think we're at all going around the general rule. I think we're saying that rule doesn't apply in this factual situation. These other rules of law do apply. And we'd ask for a reversal of summary judgment. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rose. Thank you, Mr. Conway. The case will be taken under advisement.